Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
Usually talking about corrections issues generally and parole and probation and dealing with all of the very tough issues involved. We're usually sort of the downer at these kind of meetings, but coming up before this group after the plenary session at lunch yesterday, I just want to thank Chris and Tom for letting us sort of lighten up the discussion a little bit here. It's nice to be in this role. And it is a terrific panel, and our goal today is to make sure after this hour and a half or so that you all leave here knowing exactly what needs to be done in parole and probation, right? Because this group, as Tom just said, we have all the answers here, and so look forward to imparting all of this wisdom today. I have really sort of three points I'd like to make. First is actually, despite what I just said, we do know what works at this point. We have a fairly good idea about what works to reduce recidivism, if that's how what works is defined. Secondly, that we just aren't very good at doing that yet. And third, though we should be optimistic at this point in time, as Tom just said, about squaring our actual practice with knowledge. That sort of now is the time for community corrections, parole and probation, I think, to take advantage of a lot of circumstances and factors and really really come of age. So the first point, we know what to do. I state it boldly just to be maybe a little provocative. We certainly don't know with as much certainty as we'd like, certainly not to a scientific certitude. But we know a tremendous amount more today than we did 25 years ago, say, when the prison building boom really started. We started on this path of sort of the primary response to crime being incarceration. As we started off on that path, we did not know that much about how to work with offenders. Now we know a lot more, right? We have much better instruments, risk assessment instruments, that help us distinguish in pretty significant and meaningful ways the distinction between a high, medium, and low-risk offender. We know, for instance, that we should leave low-risk offenders alone, that we make them worse by giving them laundry lists of conditions and things that just sort of trip them up over time. And we ought to focus our resources on the high-risk offenders in high-risk neighborhoods and at high-risk times, the periods right after sentencing or release when somebody's back in the community. The treatment programs that we're using today increasingly are not your father's treatment programs. They're not, or I should say, increasingly less and less sort of groups where people sit around and sort of share stories and talk about sort of exercising inner demons and repairing relationships with their their significant others and parents. They're cognitive behavioral treatments that really put people in real life situations and have them practice just saying no and other very practical and real scenarios that that actually do work. And on and on and on. A lot of folks in the room sort of know the evidence-based practice list at this point. And when you look at the research, I mean, you do find that if you use cognitive behavioral treatment programs, you can reduce recidivism by about 30% more than if you don't. If you target four or more of the criminogenic risk factors, the criminal risk factors, that are specific to that individual offender, you can also reduce recidivism by about 30%. You have Kansas and Michigan, for example. Yesterday, those of you who were in the panel with the secretaries of corrections from those two states, broad-based efforts across their corrections departments to implement evidence-based practices on both the probation and parole sides, showing also about 30% reductions in recidivism. So this is sort of not a promise, but a goal here that if we do community corrections right, using what we have learned over the past 25 years, we can reduce recidivism by about 30%. Now, why aren't we doing it? And I'd argue that more and more so these evidence-based practices are being used, but one of the chief reasons is something we documented in the report that Tom mentioned, 1 in 31. Probably fairly well known to this group, but certainly we found not the case among the media and others, was that despite the massive increase in imprisonment over the past 25 years, where we have put more than a million people behind bars than were just 20 years ago, that community corrections population has kept pace. And the two lines are very much in tandem. And really, what's sort of incredible is that you would think that's sort of the slice of pie that is in prison as that prison population exploded. You would think that the slice of the prison pie, right, would have been larger. But amazingly, it's sort of still the same. 25 years ago, we had about 70% of the offender population in the community, 30% behind bars. A million more people in prison, and it's still about the same. So while the increase in the prison population has received a tremendous amount of attention, has not been the case for parole and probation. It has grown just as fast to the point now where, yes, there are 100 people in this country behind bars, but when you look at the supervision rate, it's 1 in 45 individuals. And when you break that down even further, because as we know, crime is so heavily dominated by males, it's actually 1 in 18 males in this country is under some form of criminal justice supervision. And for African Americans, it's 1 in 11. And remember, those are not broken out by gender. So if you're looking at African-American males, that's going to be substantially lower than 1 in 11 in this country under some form of community supervision. So a huge rise in the population. The second thing that we documented in the report was the rise in costs associated with prisons. And just to be short about this, across that period of time, the last 25 years for which we have data, prisons accounted for about 32% of the growth, right? They're still in that neighborhood of 30% of the total offenders. But almost 90% of the increased spending on corrections went to prisons, 88% from those states were able to collect data of the new correction spending over the past 25 years. Went to prisons. So at this point, we're now spending, according to the 34 states we were able to collect data from, almost $79 a day per prisoner versus about $3.42 for somebody on probation. So again, to folks in the system, not a surprise, but it certainly was to others that you could put somebody on probation for 22 days for what it costs to have them in prison for one day. When you think about sort of spending $3.42 per day, what would probation look like if it was $6.42 a day or $9.42 or even $13.42? You sort of a lot of questions we got from media and others coming out of the publication of 1 in 31 was, why isn't that the case? And there really isn't a good answer. I mean, we are supervising at this point 5 million people on parole and probation in this country for what appears to be in the neighborhood of about $5 billion, maybe six. And so it is a system that is completely overwhelmed and underfunded, and it's also one that's sort of been toiling in anonymity. There's so little focus on this system, and I'd love to even just see a show of hands from anybody who from a parole or probation agency who at any point was asked by their governor or county executive to be involved in a conversation about what to do about crime in their jurisdiction. What I suspected. I've been thinking for some time. I haven't really done anything about it, but that. And one of the best ways to maybe improve performance in parole and probation would be get a TV show about a parole and probation officer, right? I mean, geez, how many cop shows have we had, right? We've had, New York cops and Chicago cops and, homicide cops and sex crime cops. They've even done sort of singing cops. And wasn't there a show for a short time about blind cops? And then we have now, isn't there, there's a show... I think it's called The Unusuals or something like that. So we have unusual cops now. So, dozens and dozens of police shows. And if we could have just one about parole, Chris, maybe you could be the lead role. So we know what to, we sort of know what to do. We have an overwhelmed system. I think, and you're going to hear from our panel today, some real good reasons to be optimistic and just to sort of set the stage for the sort of really specific situations that they're going to describe and innovations that they're working on, I'd put out a couple things. One is that public one is public opinion. It is commonly assumed that the public has sort of no tolerance for sort of the proverbial do something else with offenders, and that sort of rational policymaking in this area is political suicide. It certainly has been the case, but it really is not true. When you look at polls that are done on a state basis, whether it was in Georgia a few years ago or a fairly recent poll in Texas, and certainly national polls, you find significant, substantial majorities, two-thirds, in some cases three-quarters, public support for the general notion of doing something else. It's usually framed in the context of drug offenders, but something along the lines of, do you support mandatory treatment and testing in lieu of incarceration for low-level drug offenders? And you find that level of support even across demographic groups, party affiliation, et cetera. The second is sort of the overall trend in government toward managing for results. I think corrections is coming a little bit lately to this, but as a general matter, government is moving toward toward looking at what we get for our money, what comes out, the outcomes, rather than inputs and outputs. Certainly, the economy, obviously the economic situation, has lots of states looking for ways to do more with less. And I think, at least I hope, through our project and the efforts of folks here and a lot of you else and others in the room, NIJ, BJA, and others, growing awareness among policymakers that we actually do know what works to hold offenders accountable to victims, to reduce recidivism. There are safe and effective ways to deal with lower-risk offenders than to put them behind bars. And this is, I think, why we are seeing the Second Chance Act pass under the prior administration and Congress. It's why we're seeing states like Texas just say no to 8 more prisons, which they did in the 2007 session, even before the economy really tanked, literally facing an almost $1 billion worth of prison budget for over 5 years, and said, no, we're gonna do things a different way and build out almost a quarter billion with a B worth of new community residential treatment slots. Why we're seeing the same in Kansas and Michigan and other states across the country now. So I think for those reasons, sort of really now is the time to really pay attention to what these gentlemen and ladies have to say about what they're finding works and sort of the issues that they're grappling with across the country. So thank you.